Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, John Schwab here from Curtain Call, and welcome to episode 95 of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, the podcast that brings you backstage as close as you possibly can be, often while the shows are actually happening, to meet the people that make theater happen. You can find all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, other fine podcast streaming services. If you have a spare 30 seconds, please rate and review our podcast on whichever platform you use to help us be more discoverable to listeners who haven't heard about us yet. Now, for this week's podcast, sometimes after I sit down and chat with a guest on a podcast, I reflect on the conversation and think to myself, you know, I've just met a genius. And that is exactly what happened when Matt Humphrey and I sat down to talk with Vicky Mortimer, multi-award winning designer and just an all-round fantastic human being and theater professional. Vicky's career is so full and varied, it's definitely one to be envied for anyone considering a career in theater design. And I'm not just talking about theater as we speak about it on a day-to-day basis here at Curtain Call, but any production in a theater. Musicals, drama, dance, opera, ballet, you name it, she has designed it. And, let's just list a few of the companies she's worked with. Let's see here. Scottish Opera, Scottish Ballet, English National Opera, Welsh National Opera, Dutch National Opera, Royal Opera House, Royal Theatre Copenhagen, Glyndebourne, Lyric Opera Chicago, Metropolitan Opera. And guys, that's just a few of the operas she's worked with. How about, the National Theatre, Chichester Festival Theatre, The Globe, The Almeida, RSC's RST in Stratford, The Barbican, Young Vic, Bush Theatre. On and on, and not to mention Broadway and other theaters around the world. I could go on and on, but you really don't want to listen to me. So this week, you know, this is going to be the first part of an extended interview, and we'll bring you part two later in the year, basically in anticipation of Follies returning to the National. And this week we talked to Vicky about how she got started, the difference of costume and set design, the brilliance of Follies, and how the field of design has changed since she first started. We sat down with her at the National Theater, so there might be some background noise. I think there was maybe a talk or two happening at the National. We were there, so the foyer was quite crowded, but we found it a generally quiet space. But this is a fascinating chat. I think you'll agree. Have a listen. Quite like to start at the beginning.
Yeah. Okay.
And you trained at the Slade School of Arts.
I did.
But when did you decide that kind of the designing was the right path for you, as it were? I mean, it's quite a focus.
Mm.
Kind of, you know, being an artist in any case is like a big commitment, but then going to school, choosing to do it.
I did English literature first. That was my first sort of student experience, which was hugely helpful. And I think text was probably my primary interest at the beginning. But my parents have very three-dimensional design. So my dad was an architect and my mum was a ceramicist.
Okay.
Is a ceramicist. So there was a lot of, a lot of experience, sort of subconscious experience, perhaps, more than sort of literal exposure to stuff. So I lived, for example, in a house that we moved into when I was four that my dad designed. So I lived inside this very conscious design world. And I also remember really strongly site visits with my dad to existing buildings. The company that he worked with, the architectural practice in Bristol, which is where I grew up, were very early in adopting, picking up old industrial buildings for repurposing. So they were involved, for example, in the Arnolfini development in Bristol. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's like an art centre building that used to be a bonded tea warehouse by the docks in Bristol. And I remember going into that building with Dad when he was having a little look. Mm-hmm. And similarly, other abandoned buildings. And I think it would be no surprise to anybody who's seen lots of things that I've done, that that sort of textural narrative that you get in buildings about what the previous use has been and the clues to the stories of the people who've been there before. So what buildings and environments can tell you about the human stories inside them, I think that was probably sort of around at that time. I was a big reader, and so storytelling probably underpinned my theatre interest. And really, when I started it as a student of English, obviously the most interesting and fun people were the ones that were doing drama. So I sort of hooked onto the coattails of that. But I did, at that stage, I don't think I felt that confident about my design potential particularly. And so I did lots of different things. I did rudimentary lighting and sound and producing and stage managing and sort of bits of everything on about 40 shows over 3 years. So it was a real... That was before, when I was doing an English degree, and there were loads of student drama going on, so loads of opportunities to do that kind of thing. And I met some really interesting people, including Katie, who I then hooked up with later. And in fact, stop me when I get really boring.
No, this is amazing.
So basically, I did that English the English degree, didn't really do much academic work, but met loads of people and had all those diverse experiences. And then I had a year where I just did life drawing and stuff, and applied to Motley. Do you remember the Motley course? It was this 1 year extraordinary design training set up by this extraordinary woman, and it was a sort of intense, very professionally connected course. Anyway, I applied to that and she turned me down, which was really wise of her, because I really wasn't ready. But I then did, so then I did the 2 year postgrad at the Slade. But the great accidental arc of that is that by the time I was finishing at the Slade, Katie had done, she'd finished her degree and had done lots of interesting travelling and started to want to make her own work, done a bit of work with Payne's Plough, and so by the time I came out with a bit more of a skill base, she was making work. So we just, it was a slipstream thing. I was really lucky.
For people who don't know who Katie is, could you?
Okay, so Katie Mitchell was actually one of the very first people I met when I went to university. She happened to be in university accommodation right next door to somebody I knew from school, so I knocked on his door. He wasn't in, and this really nosy woman next door opened the door and said, "Who are you?" And it was Katie, and that's classic Katie, because she's got such a sort of appetite for meeting and interesting. Anyway, so she and I, she was the most extraordinary peer collaborator for me when I was first working in theatre, and she had a kind of an international grasp of work being made at the time. So that was 1986 when we left. But I didn't know anybody else who knew anything about Pina Bausch, Lev Dodin. She, you know, she just knew all this stuff. I don't know how she got there, but she was so sophisticated in what she was referring to that it was like a kind of tornado of doors opening and ideas. Yeah. And luckily, she invited me to work with her, and we then worked together on dozens of projects. And retrospectively, I now really appreciate the fact that I had a peer group collaborator like that, because much more commonly, young designers were then paired with much older established directors. But she and I had the chance to really develop as collaborators together. And that was just luck.
But did you start out as set designing, or such a broad question, or costume designing? Sorry for the broad question. But
Not at all. I think it's a... The thing is, training in Britain is unusual, which is that the assumption is that you will do both.
Okay.
And that's not true pretty much anywhere else in the world. Mm. But in the UK, that's been true for as long as I know. Apart from in opera or ballet. But certainly in terms of spoken word theatre, the assumption is that everybody does both. And I love doing both bits. Mm. However, I can also see that there are... You know, I think that, of course, there's a hierarchy, which I think is wrong, but there is a sort of assumption that costume design is lower down the... is less well paid. You know, I just don't get it. Mm. And in America, you know, it was a real lesson when I first went out there taking a show to Broadway, meeting American costume designers and the kind of status and, you know, empowerment that they exhibited was a real... It was a culture shock. But, of course, there is no reason why one should be. It's, I'm afraid it is largely a patriarchal issue. Men do sets, women do costumes. We are not going to pay them as well. I think, you know, but that's changing, though, too. But I think I really like the fact that you just do both. Mm-hmm. You just get on with both. Because I love the range of skills that's needed. I love the range of craftspeople that you get to work with. Therefore, you know, Polly's is a fabulous example of that. Extraordinary craftsmen from carpentry on the one end of the spectrum, and people who do hot stoning on the other, arguably, you know, the tininess of one and the largeness of the other. And I mean, if you were only doing one bit of that, it feels... a shame.
Yeah. You've been missing out.
Yeah.
I mean, just following on that, you mentioned opera and ballet, and you know, when you were training, was the scope of what you were about to kind of launch yourself into in the world of, you know, live performance, whatever, was there any focus on one of the disciplines? Because you have done opera, you've done theater, you've done dance, you've dabbled in film, you know, there's you know...
I don't think there really was. No, I think that, again, there's this sort of assumption that if you were a jobbing designer, you just had to turn your hand to whatever came up. I think possibly the exception was ballet.
Right.
I think there was a bit more of a sense that ballet was a specialist, particularly ballet costume, sort of specialist area. But actually my experience of working in ballet hasn't really borne that out. You know, I think everything, every project you do requires specialist skills. You know, that's one of the delights of it, is that no two projects are the same, and you're constantly discovering things that you don't know anything about or don't know how to do. Yeah. This is good.
I suppose it's the same as with any kind of creative, anything that we do. You know, it's a silly question to ask, because if somebody says, "Would you like to do this, John?" as an actor, I consider and go, "Yes." You know, it doesn't matter if it's a radio play or, you know, anything else. It's always something new.
Yeah.
I get that.
But,
and Matt, you know, what you get to do with your portraiture, or, you know,
how you apply what you can do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my, you know, originally it was very much spoken word that I was drawn to. I don't think I, you know, I'd never really been to the opera.
Yeah.
It was all a bit remote. I mean, contemporary dance, yeah, but not ballet. I'd never been to a ballet.
But opera is so... Okay, this is for someone who's seen tiny bits, not even a full opera, so I can't say it. But going into the opera house for, say, the Olivier's or when we did Bad Out of Hell or something, is so big, but watching opera on video, it's huge.
Mm.
So what was your first experience of walking into a design opera and going, okay, I'm going to design this?
Yeah. I think, my first opera design, proper opera design, wasn't for an opera house as such. It was for the tramway in Glasgow, and Scottish Opera were doing a site-specific-ish production. So that was a sort of soft entry, I think. But it was still... I think the sort of administrative container, if you like, or the sort of cultural container for opera is really
good.
Totally different world. Mm. And some of the... practical aspects of that really affect design are speak volumes about other bits of the psychology of opera. So, for example, there's a lot of mythology about the... It sounds a bit boring, but the design deadlines for presenting a project in opera are way earlier than they are for theatre. So opera might expect you to be presenting a design at least 18 months before you start rehearsal.
Wow. That's a big lead in time.
Yeah, it's a really big lead time. And theatre, traditionally at least, has been probably more like 8 months, 6 months, for a big show beforehand. And studio shows can be really much, much shorter than that. And so the kind of speed of action, the speed of the environment, cultural environment, creative environment, is much, much faster in theatre than it is in opera. The amount of time that you have to sustain an arc of creativity for is so long with opera that I think that's a really different discipline. And actually the weight of the machinery underpinning opera is equally kind of massive. And and so it means that you can, by the time you're going into rehearsal, everybody's a bit...
You've got new computers, outdated technology.
Something like that. It just means that all the associated thinking tends to be much more steadily paced as well. So it's more that, in a way. Not so much the scale of the thing. It's more, what you're trying to move forward.
That's really interesting, because aside from the kind of the political or scheduled... aspects of the container, as you talk about, what about the physical space as well? How much does that influence the design, and in terms of going into a huge opera house or a site specific piece or the Olivier stage here, for example, because presumably it's quite a big element to it.
I mean, just to talk about Follies for a moment, it's quite a good example, I think, because like many things, obviously, Follies was written originally with the idea of a framed performance space, so a proscenium space. So looking through something at something. And that within that, for Follies specifically, it draws on a historical memory of that style of theatre making in that style of theatre presentation. So then when the idea came forward that we would be doing it in an arena space like this, that's a really interesting part of the narrative. And it sort of turns the puzzle round, gives you a completely different starting point. So you say, okay, so what happens if you pull that stuff out from behind the frame and you start to fragment it? And, it's really exciting then. So... I would say that the space it's in is one of the main components when you first start a project, but not so much in a sort of in a, I don't know, pure design sense or an architectural sense, but more what does this space do to the piece that we're doing? And what does it do to the audience's access to it, you know? And that can include things even like how does a person get from the tube to the performance space? You know, if you're working in a more of an installed environment.
Yeah.
But even here, you know, you sort of, all of this makes a difference to how people arrive in their seat.
Absolutely. Well, we'll definitely get to that. It's a question I have. The difference between you talked about each approach when it comes to kind of opera or theater, you know, in spaces. But it's what I'd like to also know about. It'd be interesting to hear is the difference, the approach between the set design and the costume design separately, or the design of a piece, you know, the whole. Is there a different approach to set and costume, and if so, what is it? Or is there an overarching kind of approach to any piece?
It's really interesting trying to think of, you know, stand back from the process, which is, I can't say it's unconscious, but it's sort of so integrated, it's really difficult to sort of work out really what happens. And I think there's probably a variation from project to project, but essentially what I would say, if I'm doing both ingredients, is that they're really symbiotic. So it does tend to be, there are some projects which are very led by costume, and it might be that Follies is one of those potentially, but it's not necessarily led by costume because it's a costumey show. Sometimes it can just be the way into a project. Trying to think of whether there's another. Well, Thrutney was a bit like that here, and Wozzeck, that was an opera piece that I did in Chicago, was a bit like that because it's such a Weimar-y, you know, it's so much written in the aftermath of World War One, and so the impact on the bodies is very important. But I think that I have become more, partly by working with very extraordinary costume designers. So Moritz is one, Nikki Gillibrand is another, and being around people for whom that is really a specialist area and who are remarkable in the way that they think their way through a project. And I have stood back and just been so intrigued and impressed and inspired by seeing how they go about their work, and that has definitely fed in and given me much more kind of a core respect for the role of costume. And so I think I am probably more conscious of it now, so there's a bit more so things like tone, obviously, and colour, and what the subliminal narrative that costumes can provide beyond a sort of descriptive, a pure descriptive task, you know, because costumes tell you lots about the character potentially, but equally, you know, you're dressed in such a way that I could put the same clothes on somebody else and they're not telling me everything about you, and they're not and they're very transferable to somebody else, as are any elements of clothing. So it's sort of how you talk about clothing and identity in a much more sort of latent and subtle way for some shows, and then for other shows it's very much about presenting a mask or allegiance to a tribe, you know. There it's such a brilliant area, I think, costume. But I think I would say more or less the broad answer to your question is that they evolve very simultaneously, is part of it, and which is why I find it quite difficult to separate the two.
Yeah, and presumably there's a chance or a challenge that you could be kind of caught out by the other element of the design that you don't have the control over as well.
Yeah,
it goes in a direction that you don't think you wouldn't have taken it in.
Well, that's a really good. That's a really good consideration, because I think what happens when I'm working, I think mostly I have done set with somebody else doing costume. A couple of times I've done just costume. But so, for example, when I'm the set designer on a project, it's such a brilliant chance to have another designer around. Because so often you are the only one. And actually, it's the design community are fabulous here and really, really supportive and full of mutual respect. And so actually, it is amazingly, at least on the surface, non-competitive community of brilliant people. And so I think I tend to be super respectful of the other designer on the project, to the extent that I actually sort of want to just give them the area that they're looking after and respond to it myself. It's a bit more like having another director almost on the project. So yeah, then you take the risk that actually that something shows up on stage that you really, really wouldn't have thought was going to happen. But I do think that's part of the deal.
Yeah,
you have to give that other person their independence.
And that, sorry to jump
jump away.
That sense of collaboration between the designers and stepping outside of your set and costume discipline. How do you like to work, and how does it work with, for example, the lighting designer, which I presume is the kind of closest collaborator for you on a design perspective?
I mean, lighting, when I'm starting working as a designer, I think lighting was something that I had no experience really of working with lighting designers. So what I did know is they could rescue a shit design and they could destroy a good design. And so actually it was really important who that person was. But the more work I've done, I think the more I imagine lighting into the design as I go along. Not in the how to do it way, but more in a kind of what to do way. And so, one of the great advantages of working with a friend like Paulie is that it's a very natural part of a conversation. It just feels unforced and just really comfortable in the steps through the process. And working with her has really taught me lots of triggers, where moments where I just sort of log it and think, oh, that's something that I need to talk to the lighting designer about. So even when she's not on a project, our working relationship certainly informs my thinking about that. But there are a lot of really brilliantly collaborative lighting designers around now, and I think practice has shifted a lot. You know, there's a lot more inclusion of lighting ingredients sort of inside the physical fabric of a design. It's much more commonplace now.
So it's not just top.
It's not just from outside. Yeah, and I think, because it used to be, when I was starting, it used to be very much external, unless you had a table light.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that it was just a few practicals. Whereas now there's much more of an exploration of, you know, how does it affect the character of... You know, lighting has become a character in its own right much more. And so, yeah, it's a different dialogue now. And I think reference points are more associative and much less sort of practical. Lighting is talked about much less in terms of lighting, I think, than it was when I first started.
Right.
You know, that you talk about lighting using many other different terms of reference. So the great advantage of that is it is much more integrated into the other design ingredients, I think. And that's the expectation, not the exception.
Vicky Mortimer, opera, dance, ballet, and theater designer extraordinaire. Now, and she also dabbles in film. Before we wrap up, if you are a theater professional, you need to head on over to curtaincallonline.com and sign up for a free profile page. All you have to do is create an account with an email address, make up a cuckoo cool password, and away you go. You can follow us on all the socials, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. That'll be at Curtain Call. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions or feedback for the podcast, get in touch with us via any of the social media platforms I just mentioned, or write to me at john@curtaincallonline.com. And like I said, please rate, review this podcast wherever you can. It just leaves me to say a big old thank you to Vicky Mortimer for the amount of time she gave Matt and I in this chat. I mean, we know how busy she is. She's busy, people. She's busy. And we are thoroughly grateful for the opportunity to sit down with her and chat about all things design. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, and I will catch you all next week. Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.